through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hour number three of the Tom, Jake, and Stacy show. And this hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. We haven't talked to this guy in a while. Brady Henderson of ESPN.com. He appears via the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. How you doing, Brady?
Brady, are you alive?
I can't put him on hold.
All right.
There he goes.
Hey, Brady, how you doing?
For locker cleanup. Hey, what's up?
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing all right. Are we live?
Yeah, we're live.
Oh. Hey, sorry, Brady. That was on me. I couldn't get the phone to work, so I couldn't hear you. You couldn't hear them. It was a big problem.
I'm glad I didn't say anything inappropriate. How's it going, everybody?
Hey, Brady. Live radio.
Hey, Brady, is this your first time on high school radio? Because it's my first time doing it.
It is, yeah. Be easy on me.
You've been basically tagging along for the Seahawks the last couple of days here. First, I want to know, after the loss in the locker room at Lambeau Field, you know, I felt like they gave everything they had in that game, health, you know, notwithstanding. What was the feeling after the loss?
Kind of what you'd expect. There was a lot of, you know, guys just kind of staring off in the distance and, you know, a lot of hanging heads and a lot of, you know, just kind of the typical things that you would expect to hear when a team season, you know, all of a sudden ends like that. And, you know, is maybe as much doubt as there was outwardly, you know, like outside of that building about, you know, how deep of a playoff run they could make with all the injuries in there. And just the limitations on defense and everything else that might have kept them from, you know, making a run at the Super Bowl. I don't really think that they in the building really think like that. And so I think it's always kind of startling and shocking when the season ends like that. And that's kind of the sense that I got from those guys in that locker room Sunday night.
And was that feeling different as you went into locker room clean out day and it's kind of time for exit interviews for players the following day?
Well, as I was trying to tell Kyle before I got thrown on here.
Yeah, you didn't have a chance, Brady.
Yeah, I did not make it back for clean-out day because my flight got delayed back from Milwaukee to Seattle. So I actually missed clean-out day, and I just got there in time for Pete Carroll's press conference. So I can't speak to what it was like on clean-out day, unfortunately.
Wait, how is it that the Seahawks made it back? Their flight managed to get off, but all you writers got, like, stuck behind, or some of you did anyway.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure how that works. I don't know if they're bound to different, you know, regulations or whatever, but they're leaving right after the game. And my flight was supposed to leave 7:35 the next morning, and it got pushed back. And I was also flying out of Milwaukee as opposed to Green Bay, which they flew in and out of. So that's the best answer I could come up with. I don't really know.
Different FAA restrictions, regulations. I get it. Go ahead.
There's no quit.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Hey, Brady, we opened the show by talking about Pete Carroll's comparison of this 2019 Seahawks team to 2012. We don't know if we see it that way, although we can see where he's coming from. Do you actually buy that? Do you think he believes it, and do you see the comparison?
Yeah, I get the comparison. I just don't really see it quite that way. And the reason is, you know, in 2012, the core of that team, right, it was Russell Wilson, it was Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, all those guys. You know, those guys were all younger, and Russell is, what, 31 years old right now. I know he, you know, he's talked about wanting to play till he's 45, and I'm sure he has a number of good years left in him. But he's also, you know, he's not 23, 24 like he was. And you know, I don't know if the young core that they have right now is quite as good as the young core that they had back then. And, you know, the rest of that, what was that young core now? It's Bobby Wagner, it's KJ Wright. You know, what's left of it, those guys aren't really – getting any younger. So I understand what they're saying, and certainly they've got a lot of guys in that locker room that they're excited about, DK Metcalf being one of them, you know, Shaquille Griffin, another one. But I don't know if there are as many of those guys, and I don't know if those guys that they do have, I don't know if that young core that they have now is quite as good as it was back in 2012.
Brady, do you think that Pete Carroll has I'll call it a blind spot for – other than health, the defensive deficiencies that this team has? I mean, I know he's not going to throw any players under the bus, but does he have maybe a little bit too much belief in a guy like Trey Flowers and maybe what his ceiling is?
Yeah, that's possible. And if you were to ask me if there's one guy like that, it might be it. You know, a guy that Carroll kind of was pretty hands-on with in, you know, converting him from a college safety to a cornerback. And, you know, I think the other side of that is, well, who else do they have there? You know, if there's one criticism, I guess, from that game plan, it would have been, you know, and this is me second guessing in hindsight, but, you know, would they have been better off having Shaquille Griffin, cover Devonta Adams? And again, it's easy to say that in retrospect, but at the same time, you know, I think I also made the point on this station and a few others that that is a terrible matchup for them. Anybody other than Shaquille Griffin covering Devonta Adams is an awful matchup, especially if you, you know, with your pass rush not being all that great and potentially giving Aaron Rodgers a lot of time. So that would be maybe the one criticism I have of that, just because I really don't know if Trey Flowers is all that equipped to, you know, to match up with Devonta Adams. And, you know, I can kind of see it both ways, right? You've got a young guy who is a converted safety, who does have upside just because there is more room to grow with those guys who really, you know, are only 2 years into the position. But at the same time, I just don't know if I've seen enough out of Trey Flowers in 2 years to really know if he's going to be, you know, an above average starting quarterback.
Brady, it going on that conversation of lack of defensive linemen, what is the biggest deficiency in your mind? Is it the defensive line? Is there another area that you feel that this team has a glaring weakness that they have to address going into this offseason?
Yeah, I think if there's another one, it would be the secondary. And, you know, maybe you fix one of those and it helps out the other one, right? You know, just with how interrelated the secondary, you know, in terms of pass rush and pass coverage are, you know, maybe if you get, you know, maybe if you beef up the pass rush and you have one of those guys who can get you 15 sacks, you know, that can make life easier on the back end. And also, you know, vice versa, that works the other way around, right? If you've got, you know, some stat cover guys, you give the defensive line, you know, maybe that split second extra to get home to the quarterback. So in an ideal world, you fix both of them, right? Maybe you get another quarterback in there. You know, maybe you see what you've got in Marquise Blair. Maybe you feel like he's ready to take that job and you pair him next to Quandre Diggs next season. But I just think that, you know, they've got to find a way to get to the quarterback more than they did in this season. Because, you know, all the defensive issues that you can look at, I think those would be made a little bit easier if they would have gotten more pressure on the quarterback than they did.
Looking on the other side of the ball, Pete Carroll wanted to keep the offensive line mostly intact for next year. How feasible is that really, though? Because you've got some guys entering free agency, you've got older guys. Do you think that's the right move, and do you think it's even doable?
Yeah, boy, that's a good one. I think we could have a full length conversation on that alone. And I don't think it's entirely possible. I think Jermaine Eccetti, and people are going to maybe roll their eyes at this, but I think it's the truth. I think he's going to get a lot of money in free agency just because I think he is better than a lot of people realize. And there's also not that many, you know, starting caliber tackles out there, left tackles or right tackles. And when there's not that many, you know, the demand for what few there are go up. So if I had to guess his future, I think he's going to get paid a lot of money to play somewhere else next season. And, you know, with George Fant is another interesting one just because, you know, he's a guy who has said, you know, I wasn't there for clean that day, but I heard him tell reporters that he wants a chance to start. He thinks he's a starting left tackle. And, well, the Seahawks have Dwayne Brown at left tackle, so I don't know how feasible that is. And people will say, well, can you just move him to right tackle if Jermaine Eccetti is there? I don't think that's simple. It's not as simple as saying, okay, if you've seen he can play left tackle, you just put him on the right side. You're talking about two different skill sets there. So it's not necessarily as simple as saying, okay, well, maybe he could play right tackle. I know he has done that a little bit for them, but are they going to want to pay him, you know, starting right tackle money if they feel like his better position is left tackle? So I guess the short answer there, Stacey, is I don't think it's quite as simple as Pete Carroll saying, yeah, we want to keep these guys. And, you know, that's usually what a coach is always going to say, right? He's never going to say, oh, you know, yeah, we'll take or leave this guy. We'll see what happens. Coach is always going to say, yeah, we want to keep as many of our guys as we can. But with that offensive line, it's not going to be easy, I don't think.
Solid answer to a pretty big question, Brady.
Brady Anderson of ESPN.com appearing on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. How competitive do you think the rush to sign Clowney's going to be? I feel like he's appreciated and loved here a lot more than he is nationally. I don't know how other teams view him, but what do you think that market will be like for him?
I think he's going to have a huge market. And part of the reason there is that you just don't often see stud pass rushers like that or stud edge players like that get to free agency. And I mean, it happens sometimes. You saw the Packers actually sign two of those guys last offseason, and they ended up making a pretty big impact for the Packers, not only during their season, but also in that game Sunday night. So it does happen, but, you know, he's getting to free agency. And when you get there, you got a big name player like that who, you know, he is one of the more disruptive defensive linemen in the NFL. And I know we've had this conversation about, you know, yeah, the sack totals aren't there, but I think a lot of teams will tell you the sack totals don't tell the full story. It's the pressure rates. It's what he does in the run game. You saw him do that in that game against the Packers where he was all over the place, you know, blowing up running plays, chasing down Aaron Rodgers from the back end. So I think teams are going to look beyond the fact that he had three sacks during the regular season. You know, they're also going to factor into that, you know, he was playing with a core muscle injury that really left him at a lot less than 100%. So I think he is going to, if you had to ask me a number, I think it's going to be over $20 million per season. And again, this goes back to the Seahawks not being able to franchise him. If they could, they would have the tag as a last resort if negotiations broke down. And they'd also have the tag as leverage to say, hey, if you don't want to take this deal, you know, we think this is a good offer. If you don't want to take it, we're just going to franchise you. And that's how a lot of deals end up getting done, because teams have that leverage of the tag.
Now, it's interesting you say that, because this is something that they actually do, but it was basically a handshake agreement that they wouldn't put the franchise tag on Clowney. So technically they could, but it would be bad form on their part in terms of negotiations, right?
Well, I believe it's actually written into the contract.
It is.
That they cannot franchise him. So, you know, it kind of goes back to, look, that's a sign of how badly the guy wanted to get to free agency, right? He wanted to get to free agency. One more thing I'll add on Clowney is, you know, he said postgame that he wants to play for a contender, and a lot of people might hear that and say, well, you know, that's just, he's just trying to make it sound like he's not chasing the money. Remember how he nixed that trade to the Dolphins, and he later told Mike Silver of the NFL Network that he didn't want to play for a team that was, you know, quote, tanking for a quarterback. So when he says he wants to play for a contender, I think there's some credibility there. And also, from a Seahawks standpoint, like, that obviously the Seahawks would qualify there as a contender. So it's going to be difficult to re-sign him. It's not going to be impossible. And the fact that he does want to play for a contender, that I think that might narrow the field a little bit.
All right, Brady, million-dollar question here. Do you think that Pete Carroll is going to continue to put free agency and draft capital into trying to rebuild this defense and get it corrected after 2 years of really struggling? Or do you think that they're going to change philosophy and really try and build around their star $35 million quarterback in Russell Wilson?
Well, can they do both?
I believe they can do both, yeah.
Yeah, can they maybe put more on Wilson's plate and let him, you know, cut him loose while also, you know, trying to beef up the defense and not make it so that, you know, you have to have Russell. In the second half of that game, you know, they really needed Russell to put the superhero cape on and take that game over just because their defense got worked in the first half. So in an ideal world, you know, maybe they do a little bit of both. And, you know, it goes back to the Clowney conversation. If they can't re-sign Clowney, what are they going to do? You know, they're picking 27th, which, as we all know, you know, those stud pass rushers like Nick Bosa, those guys go in the first, you know, 5-10 picks. You're going to have a hard time finding one of those guys when you're picking 27th. So do they end up, you know, if they can't re-sign Clowney, do they end up making another big trade to bring somebody in like that? It would not surprise me, just because as much as the pass rush is in need right now, well, it's going to be even more of a need if they can't get Clowney re-signed.
Pete Carroll said he felt like the draft class, the 2019 draft class, performed pretty well, but L.J. Collier ended up being a healthy scratch through quite a few games. John Ursua didn't get involved until later. Obviously, you had, you know, rookie of the year candidate, I think, should have been DK Metcalf out there. But what do you make of this draft class now, a year later?
Yeah, so Collier, sorry, you just caught me sipping some of my Gatorade because my throat was getting...
Brady, you're on live radio, Brady.
Sorry, coming off the sickness. Yeah, with Collier, what I would say is, look, I understand the frustration that a lot of people have. I had some guy commenting on a Facebook post about, are they going to cut LJ Collier? No, they're not going to cut LJ Collier. You know, it takes time for some of those guys to develop. And, you know, Pete Carroll made this point, and I think I had maybe made this point earlier too, like, look at Rasheem Green. Okay, Rasheem Green last year had a, I would say, similarly quiet, maybe not quite as quiet, but he had a pretty quiet rookie season. And he, you know, developed this year into a regular contributor for them. I think he actually led the team with 4 sacks, which, you know, I guess that says as much about the Seahawks pass rush as a whole as it does about the strides that he made. But he did make a jump there, and sometimes it takes a while. And, you know, Rasheem Green was 20 years old when he came into the NFL, so he physically had some developing to do. L.J. Collier was older, but he only started for 1 season at TCU, so there was also some some developing that has to do. That he has to do. He also missed time, you know, in camp with the ankle injury too. So, look, I mean, they're not going to give up on L.J. Collier just because he didn't do anything. You know, maybe there's you know, guys that they wish that they had taken over him, but he's the guy that they got, and they're going to need him to take a jump. And I think Rasheem Green is a you know, maybe a reminder that sometimes players can't take that second year jump.
Brady, did Brady just basically tell Seahawks fans that you're stuck with what you got?
I think Brady, in a very professional way, said, y'all need to chill. You need to chill out.
Okay.
All right. Take a chill pill.
All right, Brady, thanks very much. We appreciate you coming on. Brady Henderson of ESPN.com. Thank you.
Bye, Brady.
Thanks, Brady.
All right, thank you. See ya.
And Brady appears on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. Is that kind of what he was saying? I mean,
yeah.
Well, first of all, one thing he is, I think he's definitely right about. When you're a good team, when you make the playoffs, you don't get to pick early in the first round, right? You're not going to necessarily go out and be able to draft
Nick Bosa,
the next Nick Bosa, or the next Jadeveon Clowney, for that matter, right? And,
correct.
And those types of guys, see, okay, first of all, those types of guys don't normally hit free agency, another thing Brady said. Here's the question about Clowney, though. Is he really the big-time pass rusher that normally doesn't hit free agency, or is he just the kind of guy that does because he's not as good as people think he is?
He's really good. He doesn't have the sack numbers.
He's
no,
not that
he
good.
Is. He is good,
he's,
Tom.
He's always hurt. His numbers have – he's always underachieved as far as
through,
his numbers.
He required surgery immediately once the season ended, and he played through that for several weeks, since week 10 when
so
he got
injured. So
you're
telling me that that's what I'm paying for then? I'm paying for a guy who's always hurt, whose sack numbers are always well below where they should be? Ooh, sign me up.
Why
for
does
that.
He need high sack numbers? If he's
because
going from a system,
matter.
Yeah, they do.
They,
but other things matter
the sacks
too.
Didn't
pressures
matter for this team this year, they absolutely did. They couldn't sack anybody.
No, it matters, but it's because he was always double teamed because they had one good defensive
he was
lineman.
Double teamed.
How many sacks do you think he would have gone if he was on San Francisco?
No, Tom. Not everybody gets double teamed, and also you look at the Houston Texans, and he was able to produce more than that and get close to 9 sacks or
ooh,
so.
9 sacks,
and he's a game wrecker. You watch the game, and he's a game wrecker. He destroys double teams. He's a guy who is very disruptive on that defensive line, and he has a chance for at 26 years old to continue to get better if he stays in this scheme.
All I'm saying is,
what they have to do, they have to surround him
okay.
with better talent on the defensive line along with Jadeveon Clowney, and I think you see that success really come through. To me, it's not a matter of did he play injury through injury. To me, that shows that he is tough, that shows that he's willing to be a team guy. What you're paying for is a disruptor. You're not paying for massive sack numbers. You're hoping that he can be a 9 to 10 plus sack guy, along with having better depth across the defensive line altogether. To me, that's a huge part of Jadeveon Clowney, and yes, he is worth it.
Where are they going to find that?
They're going to find other talent. There's a lot of guys. You look at free agency class right now, and we'll get into that as we really dive into free agency, but there are multiple guys across the board in free agency that I think would be very, very good fits here in Seattle that can get after the passer, that can be very nice rotational players, and that's what they have to beef up. They have to beef up their defensive line if they're going to move forward and play the same scheme and same style that they want to play with. That's a big emphasis for them.
Yeah, if Clowney on a better defensive line, better defensive team would have had the exact same numbers he did this year, as far as just sack numbers go, I think I would have been questioning more. I think the fact that he had the production he did while injured and on a team when he was the defender people were stopping. They had no one else to block. He was double teamed. I think he ended the year third most double teamed edge rusher, maybe second most of any defender in the NFL.
So you're guaranteeing me that if he weren't, he would have been...
I'm not. 16th. I'm saying that if that wasn't the case, if he was on a better defense and couldn't produce, have a lot of the same questions you do. I think I am hesitant to question as quickly what he could produce and where his ceiling is, given how bad the defense was this year.
The defensive line, you mean?
Defensive line.
I mean, you're talking about a game that he missed against Philadelphia where, you know, Ziggy Ansah actually contributed and got two or three sacks. So there's part of that that you don't know what you're going to get for him. But at some point in time, just like with Frank Clark, Pete Carroll and John Schneider are going to have a cutoff point. There's no guarantee.
I don't think you sell your soul. I know, but I don't want to get to that cutoff point.
What do you mean the cutoff point?
Again.
You mean how much you're going to spend on someone?
Yeah, combined with I think this guy's reached his ceiling.
No, are you talking about in terms of what they're willing to spend?
That's what I'm saying.
I'm saying at some point with Clowney, if he's looking for number one market value deal, no, Clowney isn't number one market value deal. He's not Khalil Mack. Mm-hmm. But if he wants $20 million, which I think is what he's worth, then yeah, I think that they're willing to pay that because of all the cap space and cap room that they have, and they can make this first year manipulate the cap room and cap space in the contract to where it's not as big of a hit. I think that they're going to be very smart about it. But if it gets to that point where Frank Clark was like, no, I want number one money type of a contract, they will let Clowney walk and they will try and find it through other veteran valued players like the Green Bay Packers did with Za'Darius Smith and Preston Smith. I think that's the route that they would try to end up taking from there.
He worries me. What's on tap?
This is What's on Tap with Tom, Jake, and Stacey. So, folks, what's on tap?
We got the Hot Stove League show tonight. Shannon Dreher will be joined by Shed Long. Is it the same crew as last time? Gary Hill, Aaron Goldsmith, Shannon Dreher?
I believe Rick Riz is on.
Rick Riz is going to be on. That'll be on from 7 to 10 tonight. And they may talk a little bit about some of this sign-stealing shenanigans, too. And let's face it, it may have affected the Mariners during the regular season. I'm sure that the Astros weren't doing this just in the postseason if they were doing it to the extent that's been alleged. This has definitely affected the Mariners. So maybe they'll be talking about that a little bit, as well as what we can expect coming up in spring training and going forward from there. How are you guys feeling about the Mariners right now, by the way? We haven't really talked about that at all.
Well, to me right now, I feel encouraged by this group in terms of knowing what their long-term plan and vision is, and knowing that they have so far in year one, they've been able to execute what they've wanted to do. And that was really first and foremost trying to turn their farm system around, and they've done that pretty quickly. And I think that part of it for me is what's been positive about year one. Now, going into year two, this is going to be really interesting to see how some of these young players, these tweener fringe players, what they end up doing, like a Kyle Lewis, a guy who has a ton of promise, a former first-round pick. Can he play at the major league level? Can they evaluate, and what is his progress going to be like? Jared Kelenic that ends up coming through, how do they handle him? So in year two, I'm not expecting much from this group, but you're going to be able to look at and pinpoint a lot of these young up-and-coming guys that they're really evaluating and really track their performance. I think that part of it is going to be really, really critical, Jamal Crawford being another guy.
Yeah, I think this year is going to be about changing the way that I maybe watch a season of baseball. So it's looking at some of those younger guys, including ones that aren't in this group yet, Julio Rodriguez, Jared Kelenic, those guys that are still in the minors and still in the system coming, or the farm system coming up to Seattle. And who knows whether either will be with the Mariners this year, but kind of keeping an eye on the development of those young guys.
Would you
on
go
that
so far? Would you go
watch
so far?
Go to minors?
I was going to say to watch Major League Baseball
or minor league,
minor, minor league,
minor league baseball. I don't mean like going to the games is cool.
Yeah.
But like I don't know, what do they stream the games?
I think I'm more of a keep my eye on news. Like Shannon Dreher has routine reports on some of the younger guys and some of the prospects. I think those are things I'll be keeping an eye on. I think two bigger questions. So questions about, is this foundation and culture that Service and DePoto are building, is that something that's going to allow those young prospects to come and succeed? Because it's not just the guys that they have coming in. You have to have the right culture, too. And so keeping an eye on what's the environment of the clubhouse like? What's the feeling of this team like? Are DePoto and Service kind of keeping a lookout to the future, or are they getting I don't know, distracted by stuff in the moment, which I don't think they will, but it's changing the way that I'm going to watch baseball.
Let's talk about that word culture a little bit and what the difference is between what the Seahawks have established and what the Mariners are trying to establish. We'll do that next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. We talk about culture a lot in this town. We talk about culture with the Seattle Seahawks and what they've created, what Pete Carroll's created. And more or less, it's just plug and play. Bring the guys in, get them acclimated to the culture, and that'll just take over, and everybody will be happy. I can't tell you how many times I've heard in the last maybe 4 years or so that the Mariners are creating a great culture. And it's happened a couple of different times because we've reloaded now a couple of different times. Here's my question. Does the culture come after you've won a little bit, or does the culture come the second that the new organization or the new regime or the new group of players gets there?
I think
how does that work? You got to win a little bit, don't you?
It's hard because I'm just looking at a football example, so this isn't the best. If you guys have a better example of a baseball organization, because it's just slower, right? The rise is slower with baseball because you've got to go through the farm system. But I'm thinking of Pete Carroll's first year.
With the Houston Astros, if you're stealing signs, you can build that culture in a
hurry. Yeah, exactly. I think it depends on the energy of the coach. Like Pete Carroll brought that culture with him because he was so not just in your face about it, but everything was, I mean, you have to think about the stuff that goes on behind the scenes with how focused on building that culture and focused on one mentality they are. And it's either you buy in or you're out.
Well, the crazy thing about baseball is in a football season, yes, they're training and they're in the building at different points in time throughout the offseason. But in baseball, they're together so often. I mean, it's a 160-game season. It's 162-game season.
Don't forget about those last six hours of play.
Yeah, that's important. And they're traveling. I mean, think about how much during the course of that season life is happening for these players. If you're a family guy and he's got kids and you've got, you know, young players, that there are so many different things that are going on in their life throughout the course of that season. And if you don't have a good culture, if you don't have good guys in that clubhouse that are, you know, I guess mainstays or calming forces and, you know, people that you can look towards in terms of no matter what's going on in my life, I can show up to the ballpark every day and be grounded. I think that that's a huge aspect of it. And so it takes a couple guys. I don't think it necessarily has to be veteran players, although that helps to show some young guys along the way. But if you've got the right group at the right core and the right culture of your manager, your GM, your support staff, right? Because it's much more in baseball than just your normal regular coaching staff. I mean, you got analytics department, you got scouting department involved. I mean, all that. It's all got to be set in stone correctly for it to blossom into what this group is hoping for. So, yeah, I mean, culture is a big part of it. I mean, think about this. Robinson Cano, one of the big parts about Robinson Cano is as talented of a player he was, one of the biggest criticisms about Robinson Cano was that it was a bad signing because he was not a guy you want to build a locker room around, a culture around. Nelson Cruz, opposite. Robinson Cano, from everything that I've heard, wasn't necessarily the best guy to have in that building, in that clubhouse to build a winning culture and establish a winning culture.
See, I don't want to debate this, but Curtis and Kyle and Stacy, correct me if I'm wrong. When Cano was here, see, I think, Jake, what you're saying now was actually true. But when Cano was here, I was told that he was a guy who, because he was such a baseball nut, was great with the younger players as far as helping them out, giving him tips, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, when they're losing, how do you know that the culture is good when the team is maybe telling you otherwise?
It's a good question, because that's the question we were kind of asking even just last year too, is how do you build a winning clubhouse and a clubhouse that's young and excited when you know going into that season, last season, and probably this season, that you're not going to be good? Like, you're going into it. People, I mean, I'm sure players are always thinking, I always want to compete and I always want to be a contender. But the front office and coaches know
right.
that it's not going to be this year. How do you start from day one that way?
If you're, you know what, if you're on the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Jaguars.
I don't know what they, what were they, like 4-12 this year? Whatever they were. The, like you were saying, Jake, the difference between a baseball season and a football season, you may go 4-12, but in those 16 games, you may learn something each week as a young player, or even that's like a positive that you can kind of develop and you can grow.
And the Jags are specifically a great example because they did do that. They think this year with Gardner Minshew in terms of building
right.
that
exactly.
culture in a losing season.
And then maybe you dismiss Tom Coughlin, you bring in a new regime, and that stuff can change a lot faster. So the mental drag of knowing that, you know what, we may go from 4-12 to 12-4 next year. Who knows? Baseball, much, much different. The young players, Stacey, that you're talking about, going into a season, how do you get them to be fired up for a season where you're going to maybe go
right.
70-92?
Well, the difference, I guess, the incentive for each one of these individual players is to show their value to this organization. That's their goal, is to show that they can be a part of this franchise and be a building piece to this group. I mean, that's what, you know, you're shocked, or at least I was. I was shocked or surprised that the Mariners went ahead and gave the contract to Evan White. But Evan White, in the process in the minor league, showed that he could be a valued piece to them at first base. He's got to go prove it now. But there you have it. I mean, Kyle Lewis was a name that I threw out there. Jake Fraley, Shed Long, J.P. Crawford. These are all guys that are really trying to prove their value long-term to this team as they're waiting for the premier prospects that they're banking on, like a Jared Kelenic and a Julio Rodriguez. I think that, to me, is the interesting part about this year, is that's what you're selling. And to go on the point about Robinson Cano, there's a difference to me of being a player, a star player, and saying, hey, youngster, let me teach you something that I learned. Here's some tips from my experience, versus saying, hey, this is what the skipper wants, this is what he wants to do, and hey, that's not the way it does. That's not the way it goes. That's, you know, this is how I do it. And so I think that there's a difference between having veteran leadership that is bought in and is totally about what the organization wants to do, from the manager to, you know, the hitting coach to everything. I think that's such a huge aspect that you're hoping guys like Marco Gonzalez provide, Mitch Haniger, Kyle Seager. You know, you're hoping that those, you know, little pieces of veteran players are bringing that type of voice to this locker, or to that clubhouse.
Can I tell you guys, by the way, when I went back to Connecticut for Christmas, I ran into a couple of friends there who are Met fans. They are not in any way happy with the fact that they had to give up Jared Kelenic.
That's great.
They are not happy.
That's good
at all.
To hear.
You'll love to hear.
Mariners.
I was asking.
You'd love to see it.
Yeah, I was asking my buddy Jason about, you know, what he thought of that trade. He's like, yeah, now I get to watch Kelenic rake for the Mariners for the next 10 years. I was like, okay, makes me feel a little bit better.
Do you want to hear some NFL news before we go to break?
Yeah, bring it on.
I think Jake's going to be more interested in this one. Okay. You can probably guess what it is.
I don't care.
LSU passing game coordinator Joe Brady is returning to the NFL and going to the Panthers.
The Panthers.
Oh, as the Panthers.
As the offensive coordinator?
Presumably, that's per Adam Schefter.
Okay, yeah, very interesting. I like that.
You're right, I don't
care. NFC news.
I don't care at all. We'll sum it up next.
The wait is over.
They're going to wave him in.
It's time to sum it up with Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Shot clock turned up.
The final word on everything that matters today in sports. Brought to you by Zone In CBD.
Step back!
You think when Pete talks to the press, he's just like trying to make us feel better, us as fans, not the press, but when he says things like, hey, right now reminds me of 2012, either he's trying to talk himself into a tizzy, like everything's okay.
I don't think Pete Carroll will ever say anything bad, at least that you can easily decipher about this team. However, I think he truly, that somber tone that he had at the end of the season, I think was in earnest.
All right, so here's Pete Carroll talking about how right now feels like 2012.
This is, I think, is the start of this team. I think this is, it feels like 2012 all over again. And y'all can, I don't want to talk about that game. You can go back and figure it out. But this was so similar.
The other thing is, maybe he's just speaking off the cuff. It's not like we're going to hold him to that.
Yeah, down the road. Yeah. I really feel like more so than anything else, he was caught up in the moment of the feel of the game and also the culture of those guys in that building saying, we were fighting, scratching, clawing, believing in one another that we could come back and win this game. And I think after, you know, you talk about that Atlanta Falcon game in 2012, they made a very serious comeback. But the difference is that afterwards, even though they lost, you felt like, okay, this is the moment that this young, studded group of and this roster is ready to take off to another level in 2013, and they've just got to add one or two more pieces. In 2020, you feel like you have, without question, one of the best players in the entire NFL and arguably the best quarterback in the NFL in Russell Wilson, who can put the team on his entire back and almost win you a football game. And you've got that piece, and you've got Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf, Bobby Wagner. You've got a really good core, but there are so many more pieces than just one or two. So many more than just one or two.
Yeah, I think you've got a good culture. You know, we were talking about building a culture and how you do that with the clubhouse when we were talking about the Mariners. I think you've got that in place for Seattle. You've got a more developed Russell Wilson. Like Jake said, you've got someone that you can build around there that isn't just a good guy to build around. It's one of the best quarterbacks in the league. But I also agree, you're more than just a Cliff Avril and a Michael Bennett removed from a Super Bowl. You've got some big decisions to make, not just with who to retain of your free agents, and not just with whether or not you add to your offensive line and what you do there, because as Pete Carroll said, he'd like to keep some stability there. You've got big decisions to make about where you invest your money. Do you turn to your defense, like Mike Salk said when we talked to him at 12:30 today? Do you, you know, he wants to throw it all that way, and he wants to go the same route that you took in 2013 because you've got the offense the way you want it. He doesn't want to change anything about it, and that's an option that some fans believe in.
You know, while we're talking about 2012, I'm going to go butterfly effect on you here.
Ooh.
Have you ever wondered what would have happened if the Seahawks held on and beat the Falcons that day and went on to maybe win the Super Bowl? Like, how different things would be here? Would they be different?
I think they could have won it the following year because everyone that was part of that core was under contract.
Would they have,
a young guy under
hold on,
contract.
Okay, you're right. But would they have bothered to bring in Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett?
Good question.
I mean, Chris Clemens got hurt in the game before. He was their big stud pass rusher that year.
Devil's advocate, I don't think that defense needed to be as good as it was to win the Super Bowl.
That's a fair point.
I think they had a reservoir of talent there.
A surplus of talent.
They did, but just knowing John Schneider, he is that guy. Even though they feel like they've got this great roster, they are going to go after that one or two guys that they feel like can take them over the top.
Do you think they would have gone after those guys anyway?
I do, just because it's in Schneider's nature. It's in Pete Carroll's nature. And that's where I believe that there is so much optimism about the table being set for 2020. Because you have this really good nucleus and you've got so much cap space, draft capital, to where John Schneider now has the ability to be very creative and very aggressive in his approach to put together a Super Bowl contending roster.
Do you guys think we could have beat the Ravens that year in the Super Bowl?
This year's Ravens?
No, yes. The 2012 Ravens. That year, had the Seahawks actually gone through that game, could we have beaten an aging Ed Reed and Ray Lewis and I guess Suggs is still playing. Flacco and
the
all
defense.
Those guys.
I will say the defense wasn't exactly what it was. They were fourth overall in total defense that year, but they weren't the best defense in the league.
Who was the following year?
Gosh, I don't.
I thought
they led
the league in scoring defense. I thought 4 years in a row starting that year.
They definitely didn't lead the league in yards allowed, passing or rushing.
Maybe not that stat.
Well, and the crazy thing is that the Ravens, they were a good football team, but they really, when you talk about like catching fire, they really caught fire in that playoff.
In the playoffs, they had lost like three or four down the stretch.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. But I guess the reason why I ask is because they went to two Super Bowls after that. Can you imagine going to three in a row winning like the first two and then losing? I mean, look, everything, I believe anyway, that everything existentially would have changed after you win that game as opposed to losing it. So who knows what would have happened and what crazy way the ball would have bounced. But, you know, we keep coming back to that game. Hey, what would have, you know, the Atlanta game. It's, in a way, it's almost a good thing that they lost it because they ended up winning the next year. They ended up coming back with a better team.
And you can also look at this group right now and say, okay, it would have been great to be playing right now. No one's saying that we wouldn't want to be doing that, but maybe in that
maybe
same
better
vein,
in 2020.
They are better off in 2020 losing this game because it forces them to look at the changes needed to be made straight in the face, and there's no avoiding it.
And what changes will there be? We'll be discussing that from now until eternity. Well, really, in just until next August, probably. It's been Tom, Jake, and Stacey, 710 ESPN Seattle.